from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Look at me. For most of us, our image of Vikings is rooted in old poets' tales and maybe comic books and maybe Wagner opera with all those horned helmets, Norse warriors pillaging, crossing seas, a new History Channel drama set in the Viking world reimagines that world once again. This hour on Point, horned helmets versus history, reimagining the Vikings. You can join the conversation. How do you picture the Vikings, their age, their time, their ways? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Oxford, England, is Michael Hurst, writer and creator of the new History Channel historical drama Vikings. He's no stranger to the genre. He wrote The Tudors, the series about Henry VIII, and the great 1998 Cate Blanchett film Elizabeth. His nine-part series Vikings premieres Sunday. Michael Hurst in Oxford, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Lovely to have you here. And with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Anders Winroth, professor of history at Yale, master of medieval Scandinavia. His big book due out next year is A New History of the Viking Age. Anders Winroth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Tom.
Let's get a little of the sound of it here from Michael's work, Vikings for the History Channel, a Viking ship moving through the water. And off they go. Now, Michael Hurst, we're going to talk about history in this hour. We're going to talk about drama. We're not going to hold you to a requirement of historical accuracy exactly after all. These are out of the mists of time, and in a way we've made of Vikings what we've wanted to make of them. But I think people are still interested in history. You're at the History Channel, but they've also got UFO hunters and full metal jousting and big rig bounty hunters. I mean, how do you begin to think about a challenge like this, dramatizing the Viking era? Are you purely thinking of what will work dramatically? Are you thinking of the history? Where's the intersection you go for, if there is one?
Well, for me, I was interested in the Vikings when I was a boy. I think all boys were interested in Vikings. But after we'd made Elizabeth, I wrote a screenplay about Alfred the Great. Alfred the Great, of course, fought the Vikings in England. Mm. And so I became interested in the Vikings and did some research, found out that, in a sense, there wasn't that much to find out, or at least there's very little written, of course, very little written at the time and often later by hostile witnesses. But what I gleaned, what I caught a kind of whiff of was something wonderful and strange. I began to read the sagas. I began to be fascinated by these people who seem to have had a very bad press, and it's not surprising because the press was written by hostile witnesses and monks, Christian monks largely. So, but anyway, that movie wasn't made, so I kept my interest, in a sense, in my back pocket, hoping that one day it would come in useful. And then about a year and a half ago, MGM asked me if, by chance, I had an interest in the Vikings. And so, of course, I did. MGM were interested because they had done, I don't know if you remember this, a rather wonderful film called The Vikings in the 60s, I think, with Tony Curtis and Kirk Douglas.
Oh, I missed that, I'm afraid.
I think you're very happy that you did, although it had its moments because Tony Curtis wore a little skirt, actually, and they both shouted out Odin for no particular reason. But when I decided that I really did want to do a series about the Vikings, there were what I definitely knew that I wanted to do. However, whatever the paucity of written information and so on, was to try and tell the story from a Viking point of view, which I thought was pretty unique and unusual. I love by this stage and doing more reading. As many historical accounts as I could, because that's the only place I can get my information from. I'd grown to be even more fascinated by their rituals. I'm fascinated anyway by paganism. And two things kind of immediately stood out to me, as it were, from the historical perspective, was that compared to other societies of the time, they were relatively more democratic. It might have been the survival of the fittest to some extent, but they had these meetings called the Thing, in which they discussed legal and judicial matters. And in terms of their relationship to women, they were almost progressive. I mean, women could divorce their husbands. They fought in the Shield War, and they could rule. And so there was already an idea that they could be my heroes, as it were, because the big stumbling block from a dramatic point of view, and the reason very little has been written about, dramatized about the Vikings, is this problem about the universal perception is them of the other, that they come into your room, they break down the door, they rape and pillage. They're the bad guys. They're the universal bad guys. They are violent to an extraordinary degree. And yet I wanted to make them my lead characters. I wanted to see the world through their point of view. And there was one last thing that gave me a pretty strong clue that I could do this, was what I learned about the character of my central character, Ragnar Lothbrok, one of the first great Viking leaders to emerge from the mists of myth, I think, and legend. Ragnar regarded himself as being descended from the god Odin, and Odin, apart from being the god of slain warriors in Valhalla, was also the god of poetry and of curiosity. He willingly sacrificed an eye to look into the well of knowledge. So I thought Ragnar too could have that similar fascination and curiosity for other things. That's
you show
why
them as technology innovators and explorers, really, kind of almost like almost astronauts of their age, heading across seas that had not been crossed. Anders Winroth, the reputation that the Vikings have for rape and pillage as the number one characteristic, is it deserved, Anders?
Yes, it is. It definitely is. They were very violent, but they were not really more violent than anybody else at the time. It was a very violent time. The reason why we think of them as extraordinarily violent is exactly what Michael says, that the reports we have about them are mainly from their victims.
Because those were often monasteries where monks would keep records, and in Scotland or England or you name it, and so it comes down to us.
Exactly, and they were literate, and they wrote things down, and it has been preserved for us to read. We have some of the other side of the story as well, because we have some things that the Scandinavians wrote down in the Viking Age as well, on runestones, and also in poetry that they wrote at the time.
Give us the history in nutshell as we know it. What was the Great Viking Age? Who were they? Were they all from Norway? Was it Sweden too? Where? And how widely did they range?
Well, they were from all of Scandinavia. There might even have been people who were not Scandinavians who joined them. And they sailed around, traveled around all of Europe, from Constantinople to Ireland, to Greenland, to Newfoundland, everywhere, seeking opportunities of different kinds. Some of them traded, some of them raided and plundered and killed. I don't think one should draw too strong a dividing line between the people who traded and the people who raided. They did whatever they had the opportunity to do.
What years were the heyday of the Viking era culture?
It's sort of from around 800 to, the 793, the famous raid of the monastery of Lindisfarne, which is in this drama. Is when it's sort of tradition is thought to start, and then it sort of clings off during the 11th century. And the last great Viking invasion might have been the Norwegian Harald Hardruler, who went to England in 1066, a few weeks before William the Conqueror, and was defeated.
And is it true, all Wagner aside, that they didn't wear horned helmets? I mean, we really love our horned helmet vision of the Vikings, Anders.
Yeah, it's very nice with horned helmets, but you know, it's not very nice if you're going to fight with swords if you have a horned helmet, because you will be unhelmeted in 30 seconds.
It catches the sword and off it goes.
Yeah, exactly. So it's useless for a defensive point of view. It's really literally Wagner's the world premiere of the Ring des Nibelungen, and that's when they were first seen in that form.
Michael, we just got 30 seconds before the break. Did you resist horned helmets in your drama, Michael?
I never for one moment thought of putting them in horned helmets.
Good, right, thank you.
So it's not Wagner. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Vikings in history and now on cable. The History Channel's bringing them back. Sound there from an opening battle scene from Vikings. It premieres this Sunday. We're looking at what we really know about and how we like to imagine Vikings with Michael Hurst, writer and creator of the new History Channel series. With us from Oxford, England, Anders Winroth is with us from Yale University, professor of history there, author of the forthcoming A New History of the Viking Age. Central kind of tension in Vikings, the History Channel version, is when a new generation of Vikings want to set out to the west, the unknown west, not back to the Baltics and the east. Here's the hero of the series, really, maybe from history, Ragnar Lothbrok. Kind of like that name. Fighting here with his, or arguing with Earl Haraldsson, his local chieftain, played by Gabriel Byrne, about where they should go raiding next.
Every year, we go to the same places. But there is an alternative. If you choose. Oh, yes, yes. Choice, yes. I've heard of these rumors, these stories, that if we travel west, that we will somehow reach a land that is rich and plentiful. But I tell you that I will not risk my ships or my reputation on such a deluded fantasy.
From Vikings, the History Channel version, Michael Hurst, how did you get the notion that would have been a revolutionary idea to sail west?
Before I answer that, could I just make two points? So that, as you said, you like the name Lothbrok, which I think means, Anders, I think it means hairy breeches, doesn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great. What a visual. Okay.
Yeah. And the other thing I just wanted to say, and I don't know whether Anders would disagree, but going back briefly to this idea of their extreme violence, I think that their reputation for extreme violence suited the Vikings very well, because if you could imagine, certainly in the early raids, they were setting off to unknown or relatively unknown countries, probably in one or only two ships. So you have about 60, 70 warriors, something like that, which are a finite resource as against the countries that you're going to attack.
Yes.
So you have to be very careful. You don't lose many more men than you need to, and you have to pick your. So of course, to come with a reputation for shock and awe,
yes,
does you a great deal of good. And I think they, in a sense, they played upon that reputation.
Tactical value, if nothing else. Yeah.
Yeah. The idea of them sailing west. Well, of course, as a dramatist, you're looking for a moment of change, a moment of disruption. I mean, that's drama. Sure. So during my reading, this obviously came up, and it was obviously a way to get the series underway. And I will defer in every respect to Anders, who knows I'm a writer, not a historian, and I had historical advice. But I mean, I think as far as one could say that we tell the story fairly truthfully. I mean, but without going into the reasons that they went west, and I think there are many reasons, and there are complicated reasons, and people disagree. I mean, whether it was population explosion or whatever, it was nice to think that they'd actually found a new way of navigating just dramatically. You know, it was, yes. and the fact that they could build these incredible vessels, these wonderful ships, as you say, starships, you know, that they were still an Iron Age culture. Essentially, they couldn't make pottery, as far as I know. But yet they could do things.
Not very good pottery.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but yet they could build these extraordinary ships that could sail across open oceans that reached, you know, North America hundreds of years before Columbus, and could not only cross oceans but then could go up rivers. I mean, how frightening was that for people who first saw them?
And appear with those great sort of dragon heads on the front. Anders, explain what took them to the seas. Was there a population explosion? Was it trouble? I don't know. At home, was there not enough land to farm? Were they just an adventurous folk? And what about the move to the west? I mean, the British Isles first, and then much, much farther to, we're told, the New World.
Yes, indeed. They were looking for opportunities. They were looking for ways to become richer and get more stuff, as it were. And they went in all directions to find it. It's actually what's funny about West and East is that it's actually the East that they discovered. They had gone to the East already in the 8th century to get fur, which they could sell at great profit on the markets of Europe.
And by East, and do you mean what we think of as Russia now or beyond?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they would go further and further in. And then they would suddenly find that there were other people living on the other side of the Russian forests, they found Arab traders and Byzantine traders also wanted to trade with them. So that was one of the big discoveries of about the time around the year 800.
And they had real commerce in that direction. I remember reading in classics courses years ago, Vikings actually showed up in some of the wars in the Byzantine Empire. Oh, yes. I mean, down the Volga and all the way into sort of Greece and Turkey.
Yes, the Byzantine emperor preferred to have Scandinavians as his bodyguard because they had no local contacts, so they could be expected to be loyal. The West, the Scandinavians had known for a long time because they always been traveling to the West overland or probably overland earlier on. What really happens to start off the Viking Age is that they get this wonderful shipbuilding technology that allows them to build the kinds of ships that Michael describes. And I, by the way, I've seen some of the early episodes of the series, and I thought it was quite nice how he had put in some elegant allusions to real historical facts.
What were the technology innovations historically, as far as we know, that let them sail further and better?
Well, they got the sail, for starters, which for some strange reason the Scandinavians don't seem to have picked up on very early, even though the Romans used sails. Mm-hmm. The boats from sort of the contemporary boats to the Roman sailing boats were rowboats in Scandinavia. Mm-hmm. But then at some point, maybe 100 years before the Viking Age, they get the sail and they start to be able to sail across large expanses of water.
They also remodeled, reshaped the boats, didn't they, though?
Yes.
They built them in different ways.
Yes, and I thought it was quite nice how you got that for like 10 seconds. You get this character talking about building the boat and alluding to some of the things that in fact were innovative of what they were doing.
I mean, they certainly felt empowered by that, that ability to go far, and then that shallow draft that let them go up river, and suddenly they're in the
midst of... And then they could row again up rivers, which they needed to do.
And when they got up those rivers, they found very different cultures from their own. Here's a little bit, again, from Michael Hurst's Vikings. Ragnar Lothbrok eventually makes it west. He's pillaging a village in England, I guess, here. Finds a Christian monk, Athelstan, trying to save a Bible in a ransacked church. The book and the religion, in the dramatic telling here, confuse the Viking.
What is that you have in your hand? A book. The Gospel of St. John. I wanted to save it. Of all the treasures I see in this place, you chose to save this. Yes. Why? Because without the Word of God, there is only darkness.
All right, Michael Hurst, your Viking speaks pretty darn good English there.
Well, now.
I mean, it's all we understand, so fine.
Yeah. I don't think, frankly, an American audience would stand it for very long.
Old Norse, if
they were speaking Old Norse.
No, I think
although,
you're right.
to be fair, when we first meet the Vikings, they do speak in Old Norse. And when we first meet the Saxons, they speak in Anglo-Saxon.
How do you picture that meeting of this culture and, I guess, as you say, still a pagan culture at that time, and the Christian monasteries and more they found in England?
Well, of course, that's at the center of the drama. That's at the center of my interest in a way, and it's a subject that develops through the season, and Athelstan the monk becomes a very important character. Ragnar takes him back home. He's curious about Athelstan's God. He's curious about the book. I mean, what you obviously, this is radio, so you couldn't see what Ragnar had actually done with the book, that he assumed that it was a container for something, so he shook it and he shook the pages to find out what would fall out. Mm-hmm. So he's fascinated, and he probes Athelstan about, he wants to know what this God is. And at the same time, Athelstan has a crisis, a religious crisis, spiritual crisis, because of course he feels that God has abandoned him. How has God allowed this to happen? Mm-hmm. Was there a reason? Initially, he clings to the idea that God must have a purpose in this. He starts to lose his faith. And at the same time, he becomes somewhat attracted to what he understands of the pagan religion. He becomes very interested in it. And there is although I say so myself, but it's an extraordinary episode, episode 8, which is called The Sacrifice, when they take Athelstan to a place called Uppsala, in, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right, in Sweden, where every 9 years they sacrificed nine of everything, including nine people, and Athelstan is witness to that, and I think it's a very powerful episode. And as I said at the start, I personally am really, really intrigued by paganism. We know very, very little, I think, about paganism, and that's partly because it wasn't written down, but also partly because when Scandinavia became fully Christianized, they destroyed all the evidences. The temple at Uppsala, which had carvings of the gods inside it, was destroyed, flattened, and a church, I think, was built on top of it. And paganism was deleted, basically, from history. So, but I find it really interesting.
I want to bring our listeners in. We'll look at paganism and more. We've got many callers here. Hamilton, Massachusetts, Kirsten is calling. Hello, Kirsten. Thank you. You're on the air.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Thank you. Shall I go ahead?
Yes, please.
I guess I'm just calling. There were kind of three points that I wanted to make. I'm 100% Scandinavian. My mother's Norwegian. My father's Swedish. Mm-hmm. I was back in Norway with my mother just after Christmas, visiting relatives in Norway. And the couple points I want to make. One was that the reputation of the Vikings for having such a violent disposition, whatever. They were the explorers, the people on the fringe, the people that were going out and doing all this stuff. But the people that stayed at home in Norway were really skilled farmers and craftsmen and I mean, my family history goes back there to the beginning of written records.
So don't think of all the Scandinavians as Vikings. Okay, we take that.
The ones that were out.
Yeah.
The other thing, while I was there visiting, I spent some time with a relative who has a degree in history from the University of Oslo in Norse and Viking history. And he said that Vikings actually never wore horns on their helmets, that that was the way they were depicted by the rest of Europe and other parts of the world to make them look more demonic.
Yeah, Kirsten, we've got it, and we've heard Anders speak to the horns, but let's speak to this issue about who was what, Anders Winroth. I mean, I've got family going back to Sweden as well, and been back recently, and talking with them, and I don't know why it came up, but they're saying, oh, yeah, like Kirsten, the Vikings were the fringe of society. They were the outliers. They were almost the pirates. They weren't the mainstream. Is that true, Anders?
I think it is. I mean, there were people looking for opportunities. If you had a big, good farm at home, mm-hmm. why would you go out on this risky business where you could just as well be killed, mm-hmm. maybe in fighting, maybe just sailing, if you ran into a storm? So I sort of think of the people going out to raid in Europe as you know, the younger sons and people who did not get to succeed to the farm and so forth.
What about the notion that they were more democratic than other cultures of that day? Can we know that? Do we?
Well, I mean, I think it's early medieval society was actually more democratic than late medieval society and much in the modern period, that a lot of things were dealt with locally. And that applies in Scandinavia as well as in the rest of Europe. The judicial system in the early Middle Ages is very much focused on congregations that are sort of similar to the thing of Scandinavia that Michael spoke about earlier. I think this is 19th century Scandinavians who like to think of Scandinavia as the origins of democracy in some sense that push this hard, because we know more about it in Scandinavia than we do for the rest of Europe.
And what
thanks
about,
to these sagas?
And what about when they traveled? We know they often came back with their booty, but did they also integrate? I mean, did they stay in? We know they were in Iceland. We know they're in Greenland. But what about Scotland and the British Isles? Did they integrate with the population there?
Oh, they moved in everywhere. The east of England is known as the Danelaw, the area where Danish law, Danish meaning Scandinavian, not Danish particularly, was applied. And a lot of Scandinavians settled there. And we see that in the place names there. We see it just in the English language. There's so many words that we use all the time that we don't think of as being foreign, but actually Norse words.
Like
and York was York is a Viking town,
but
Dublin was built by the Vikings. Normandy in France means the land of the Northmen, because the King of France gave them Normandy. So they conquered bits of it, then assimilated. They were wonderful assimilators, and you know. You've both, you know, Tom, you have, as you said, you've Swedish blood. Mm-hmm. But I said when I was selling the show, I said, walk four blocks from any office and you pass 40 Vikings.
Who knew? Who knew? We'll come back and grab some of those Scandinavian words in the English language. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking Vikings this hour in history and now on cable. The History Channel's bringing them back with the 9-part series Vikings premieres on Sunday. It's writer and creator Michael Hirst is with us. He also wrote The Tudors and Elizabeth with Cate Blanchett. Anders Winroth is with us from New Haven, Connecticut, author of the forthcoming A New History of the Viking Age, professor of history out of Yale. Lots of questions and callers here. Let's go to Hawaii, Honolulu, Hawaii. Paul's calling. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show. I've been a Viking aficionado for a long time. I went to university in Sweden and speak Swedish. So I have a linguistic question and a historical question.
Okay.
The linguistic question is, Well, you mentioned the effect of Old Norse. There's quite a few words we use today that the origin is Old Norse, like stick and muck and things like that. They're usually agricultural terms.
Okay, good.
The Vikings were settlers, and they were farmers in those parts of England.
Mm-hmm.
The linguistic question is, why did Old Norse die out everywhere except Iceland? For example, Swedish and Danish are quite separate from Old Norse. And the historical question is, are your guests familiar with the Kensington Runestone in Minnesota? And do they believe it's authentic or a fake?
Let's go language first. Paul, I'm so glad for your call. Anders Winroth, what about Old Norse and why it died out, where it died out?
Well, it didn't die out, it just developed,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the same way that we don't speak Old English anymore, we speak modern English, that we speak French and not Latin. So it's just a development of it. It's just that there was less development in Iceland.
So Iceland's so, closer to it. And what about the North American footprint of Vikings? The Leif Erikson stories, if that's part of this, I don't know, or more, even deeper into Minnesota. What do you make of a runestone there, fact or fiction?
The Vikings were certainly in North America. There's no doubt of that. There's a Scandinavian settlement on Newfoundland that's clearly Scandinavian. The Kensington Runestone, it's not written in Old Norse. It's written in 19th century Norwegian, so I'm afraid I can't believe in it.
Okay.
Can I give a sentence that's a short sentence in English with only Scandinavian loan words?
Oh, yes, please.
They seem wrong.
All from Old Norse?
Yes, all three words. It would be completely different in Old English. They are taken from, borrowed from Old Norse during the Viking Age.
Wow, that's great.
In the book that you mentioned that's coming out, I have a full paragraph, a short story that's written by my dear colleague Roberta Frank, who actually was the one who wrote the famous article about the horned helmets and Wagner and all that.
Yeah.
She has written this paragraph, this story, entirely with Norse words and no English words.
I love it. Stick and muck and they and wrong. What about women in this culture, Anders? What do we know about their position and how it was like or unlike the position of women contemporaneously in other societies?
I think it's pretty similar. There were, of course, women, and there were, of course, some women who had a more prominent position than others. I mean, that's very well known from the archaeological material. And as well as from the written material. I don't think one can think of Scandinavia as exceptional in the sense of gender relations, as well as one can't think of the Vikings as exceptionally violent.
The History Channel series gives them certainly an image of strength. Here's a little bit where actor Catherine Winnick, playing Ragnar's wife, a shield maiden, we'll talk about that, discovers two men looking to take advantage of her while her husband is away from the village.
If you're thirsty, I will give you a drink. If you're hungry, I will feed you. Otherwise, you must go.
We will eat and drink after we've satisfied our other needs. I don't want to kill you, woman.
You couldn't kill me if you tried for 100 years.
Michael Hurst is writer and creator. Michael Hurst, what's a shield maiden to begin with? And then what about your depiction of women here?
Well, I think a shield maiden is really just a way of saying a fighter, that a woman who fought in battle with men. And Lagertha, Ragnar's wife, was called, like Brunhilde, I suppose, was referred to as a famous shield maiden who fought with him. And it was interesting that the casting of the show, because in the case of both Ragnar and Lagertha, Ragnar, I didn't want a normal hero. And we were offered, believe it or not, to begin with, a lot of English very pretty actors. They're the sort of they're the ones who are being cast for everything at the moment. And to me, they didn't look as if they could even lift up an axe, never mind use it. So we were looking for very physical types. And I also said that there has to be a depth to this guy. because it's too easy to sort of exaggerate the sort of Viking persona. Mm-hmm. Most actors are filled with the same preconceptions that the public is about how big and brave and blistering these people are. So I wanted a thoughtful lead character, and I think we got one in Travis Fimmel. And similarly with Lagatha, of course, you're offered, you know, beautiful young women, you know. Mm-hmm. But I
when you're casting,
mm-hmm. when you're casting, yes, that's me. And I knew that I needed someone. She'd had two children, and she'd fought in battle. So, and it was terribly hard to cast someone who could do that convincingly. Catherine Winnick, who came up, as it were, at the last moment, is a black belt. And she, in judo, and she found the physicality wonderful and liberating. And she said, I've been working in American TV for years. I've never had a role like this. I've never had the opportunity to express my physicality. And that's so, in the sense that, you know, women could be equal with men, and that was what I meant, you know, that it even came down to how we cast the show.
Anders, what about the idea of women warriors, shield maidens, fighting side by side with their Viking men?
I'm sure it happened. There is actually a story from a Byzantine chronicle from the 11th century that after a battle, the Byzantine armies were surprised to find dead fighting women on the battlefield. This was after they fought some people that looked like they could have been Scandinavians. But the story about shield maidens is very interesting. I mean, it's a rich theme in the sagas that were written later in the Middle Ages, especially in Iceland. And there you have a lot of them, which is where, you know, Wagner picked up on Brynhild, yeah, and so forth. I mean, and these are literary themes, mm-hmm, that, you know, go through history. You have the Amazons in Greek, mm-hmm, mythology and so forth. I think the way they are portrayed in the sagas is really a literary development of this theme. But I can't see any reason why women could not have fought during the Viking Age.
What about those sagas? We spent an hour not so long ago, I don't know why this has all come to us, but talking about Snorri Sturluson and the sagas written out of Iceland. Now, those are written hundreds of years after Vikings were in their prime. Is there any notion that those... you can look to them for history, or is that pure fancy? Where does history come from? Do you read the runes? Is the full story told?
What I read to get to the history are the runes and some of this old poetry, some of which is quoted in those sagas from the High Middle Ages. Mm. Both the runes and the poetry give very little information because they're very short, and they also have their genre-specific ticks, as it were. But you can sort of start to puzzle that together when you then confront that with the archaeological material and what these monks and other chroniclers around Europe wrote about Scandinavians.
What about the boats? They were wooden, obviously. I mean, and it is amazing, Michael, as your series points out, made without the advantage of saws even, just axes. But did they survive in some state, Anders? Can we see? Do we really know what their construction was?
Yes, I mean, there are some Viking Age ships that have been preserved. The best preserved comes from a burial mound a little south of Oslo, which was excavated in the 1920s. It's almost completely preserved. You can see it in a museum in Oslo. Mm-hmm. What really was surprised the archaeologists in the 1920s is there was this magnificent burial with this huge ship and a lot of other valuables. And the two people buried in it were two women. Which goes back to our previous point about gender relations.
And your characterization, Michael, but what do you make of that? Some cultures, the women die or are killed to go with their dead husbands. Does it look like an honor or thrown on the on the funeral pyre?
Well, we actually have a real-life description of a Viking burial from, I believe, an Arab trader in some detail. Describes watching the burial of an important man. And it's still a very, very shocking account. The drunkenness, the cutting up of horses and other animals to throw into the boat, and the murder of the slave girl who has, in theory, selected herself to go with her lord and has to do a number of rather unpleasant rituals before finally being, as it were, sacrificed by the angel of death. And, of course, being a dramatist, I've used that material. And in episode 6, there's a great Viking burial.
I'm sure you latched straight on to that. Ari in Burlington, Vermont. Ari, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a mushroom foraging educator. I have a blog called The Mushroom Forager. And one thing I've encountered in my research is a lot of stories of Vikings consuming the fly agaric mushroom, Amanita muscaria, as a sacrament before entering a berserker state when they would raid and pillage. I was wondering if there's any real historical accuracy to that myth that I've heard.
A wonderful question. Anders, how about it? Taking potent mushrooms to go berserker state. What do you know?
It doesn't work, I think. I wouldn't recommend it. This is the idea of a 19th century amateur historian who was trying to explain these berserks who supposedly fought in a wild rage. And he thought, well, if they take some kind of hallucinatory drug, such as mushrooms, this would work. There's no historical evidence for it, unfortunately. There's actually very little, I would say, no historical evidence for the existence of the berserks in the first place anyway.
Well, there's a lot to untangle here. Gosh, I can imagine, though, well imagine, Ari, how the mind goes back there. Oklahoma, Oklahoma. Eli, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wondering about what time the mythology of the Norse gods came about. And also, were there any notable Norse philosophers?
Wonderful. Anders, what about the Norse gods and their timetable? How does it intersect with the Vikings? Did the Vikings, make them up? Or were they already there?
They must have been there before that. I mean, we know very, very little about that. But the most of what we know about Norse mythology was written down long after Scandinavia had been converted to Christianity. We imagine that Scandinavian people must have had some religious ideas long before we know about them.
Of course.
And we can imagine that. I mean, we can think of one thing that's interesting. You know the name of the week. Day, Tuesday, has the name from a Scandinavian god whose name is Tyr. Mm. He must have been an important god, since he's one of the three gods who gets a weekday after him. But we know almost nothing about him, apparently because people knew nothing about him in the 13th century when they started to write these things down, which suggests that he was an old god that once had been important and no longer was.
Yeah, depiction of some of this in the series Vikings. Here's a little bit where one of the Vikings tells the monk who's come along with them and young children gathered around a campfire about the mystical land of Valhalla, where warriors go after they've died in battle.
Nearby is Valhalla, vast and gold bright, and every day Odin chooses slain men to join him. They arm themselves and fight in the great courtyard. They kill one another, but every night they rise again and ride back to the hall and feast.
And there it is from Michael Hirst's Vikings. Michael, if there's something beyond the drama and the stories, and you tell them vividly here, what's the thing you would like people to come away with seeing, understanding, feeling about Vikings that they might not have before your series?
I'd like two things. I'd like, for a start, that they enjoyed the series and got involved with and engaged with the characters, because that's the way these things work. That's your main objective as a writer. I mean, you, as it were, fall in love with your characters. They don't always have to be good or pleasant, but you sort of fall in love with them that allows you to write about them. And in a way, you want your audience to share some of that love, at least to be intrigued by them. But you also, because this is based on historical fact and research or whatever, you want people to encourage people to go and do their own reading and get involved. I mean, the Tudors, of course, spawned a whole industry, and I think really encouraged, and certainly from the messages, texts and so on I've received from American universities and schools and things, spawned a huge interest in Tudors, and hopefully this will in the Vikings too. So, Anders, I hope that it helps your book a great deal.
Well, thank you.
That would be swell. Anders Winroth, what about you? If there's one correction to the mainstream popular perception of Vikings that you would promote, what would it be?
Don't think of the Vikings as exceptional, really, in any sense. I think they were pretty typical early medieval people. They were the way that early medieval people were, and they've just been portrayed as exceptionally violent, as exceptionally democratic, and exceptionally equal between the genders and so forth. Don't buy it. I don't think it's true.
Wow. You may be right, but when they came ashore, they sure made an impression.
Anders, I think they were exceptional.
All right, Michael says exceptional. He's got the series coming on. Our historian says don't look at it that way. Well, it was a tough time, and they were active all over, right in the middle of it. Such a pleasure to talk to the two of you today. Anders Winroth at Yale University. Look for his new book coming out next year, A New History of the Viking Age. Anders, thank you very much for your time and insights today.
Thank you very much.
And Michael Hurst, good luck with the series Vikings. It premieres Sunday on the History Channel. Michael in Oxford, England, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.